Welcome to Kentish, the Formula Ford podcast. It's been over 54 weeks since our last podcast. I was not lost at sea. I was not buried alive. I'm here. Just a matter of COVID happened, life happened. Here we are. So for our 13th episode, and this episode, as always, is brought to you by Shippert Racing Services, we have with us Scott Fairchild. Scott, welcome to Kentish.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's awesome. Obviously, you have one of the fastest Club Fords in North America right now. We'll get into that car. But first off, how about you tell our listeners where you're from and kind of how you got into racing in the first place?
So I'm from Palatine, Virginia, which is just outside of Richmond. I got into racing the way I think most of us got into racing, which was not necessarily a straight path. So we had a few different iterations of cars before we actually figured out what we needed to do to get on track and ultimately get into Formula Ford. It started building a kit car when I was a teenager, and I've always had a passion for cars. I was able to, my dad and I built a 911 RS clone out of an old 912. Mm-hmm. And at that point, VIR was just getting rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And they were the first to really do this club member thing. Mm-hmm. And one of a gentleman that was in my dad's Bible study was also a car nut, and he invited us to a driving day, a club member day. Mm-hmm. And so we said, oh, well, 9/11, that's perfect, and kind of did that for my 19th birthday. And after a couple of days, a couple of those days, we said, well, this car's a little too nice to potentially wreck it. Maybe we should get a purpose-built race car. And got into the vintage sports racer scene. I happened to be looking at a Formula Ford at the time because I was a freshman in college and, you know, trying to see what I could work little jobs to afford. And I can't remember if it was an 84 Renard or like an 85 Euroswift, but I remember the car was yellow and it was for sale and they wanted like $6,000 for it. And I was kind of like, this is it. Mm-hmm. And we ultimately went a different route with a sports racer because not very many track days had open wheel groups at the time. This was back in 2001, 2002. So we ended up going with a really cool sports racer that was kind of a one-of-a-kind thing called a PDF. And they were a company out of California. And I mean, this thing screamed and it, you know, had very questionable brakes, but, you know, it can go 159 miles an hour and you didn't know if you were slowing at the end of the straightaway. So,
wow.
That was living.
Wow. And what powered that beast?
So initially they were designed for a bunch of different motors, Dobbs, Fiat motors. They were C and D sports racers, and this was right before the monocoque era.
Okay.
So think like Lotus 23 type of sports racer.
Okay.
But this had PDS was mainly known for their engine work on Fiat engines. And we were able to acquire a few of kind of the top line ultimate development they had. They cast their own cylinder heads and machined all their own parts, but they made six cylinder heads and four of this style cam carrier. It was a 1300cc 16 valve engine that revved to like 12,000 RPMs.
Wow. And again, that's based off of originally a Fiat block, correct?
A Fiat X19, yeah. They
Oh, God. So let me quickly just bite in here. So my dad had an X19 that sat in our driveway on, like, one tire that was full of air, and the UPS man would use it to put packages in. And that's all I got. Go ahead.
No, it's, you know, believe it or not, they were actually, the X19 motors were built really well.
Mm-hmm.
This car at various stages in its history had one of those, you know, non-cross-flow, single-overhead cam X19 motor.
Okay.
And that was really hopped up for what the chassis could handle mm-hmm. at, like, 105 horsepower. But this motor that PBS developed for one of their later sports racers, and they actually used it in a Formula C car, back when it was more like a Formula Libra.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, they tested it in a Mark IV, which was the model of our sports racer. So we said, okay, let's replicate that car, because we found one of these six engines. And anyways, we could never find an original crank or rods that PBS had made, because they you know, built those from billet. And so we were using stock X19 rods and cranks, and never had a failure. It just had such a short stroke that they were bulletproof.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we have in our shop, we borrowed a car a few years ago, and I'll tell you what it is in a second, but we borrowed it to put on the back of our XP lovely Thames Transporter, and the owner has basically said, just keep it at our shop, because he's got nowhere to put it. It's a 1959 Stanghelini Formula Junior, and it has the Fiat 1100 motor, which at one point ran, and we're tinkering with at the moment to get back running. So Fiats are they're interesting little beasts, we'll say that. So
yeah, the Italians like to make everything look good, mm-hmm. and sometimes it works well too.
Yeah, there is that. So how did you cross over into Formula Ford, and what was your first car?
So Dad and I shared that sports racer and co-drove. And then toward the end of 2005, some more friends had been getting... Club Ford wasn't big in vintage at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so some more friends were starting to get the classic Fords. Monoposto was big at that time. And so we just kind of were getting this itch for it. And a gentleman by the name of Bob Browski had a gorgeous Royal RP3A mm-hmm. for sale. And so we took that home 2 days before Christmas in 2005, and Dad was going to drive that car, which he did for a couple of seasons. And I mean, that thing was awesome. Everybody should own a Bob car at some point in their life. He does the most amazing restorations, and you know, things are polished under the fuel cells where nobody else would be. So, yeah, and then you know, the sports racer went down for a very prolonged restoration, and we decided to get a second Formula Ford, which was Merlin 11A,
mm-hmm.
and so Dad got the 11A, and I got put in the Royale, and, I mean, we fought tooth and nail for a number of seasons with those two cars, and ultimately... fall of 2010, I switched over to Club Ford. My wife and I were expecting, and she didn't say it, but I could tell she wasn't crazy about no front roll hoop. And so she's always been great supporting my racing, and I didn't want to tempt fate.
Yeah, I totally get that. And actually, the Eldon that we just finished restoring, our Mark 10B, that was formerly our friend Michael Argetzinger's car, that does not have a front hoop. But the way we look at it, the Eldon's a tip up front end anyhow, so I think we're okay. So
it's a gorgeous car online anyway.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a lot of work, and it's meant the world to us because I've said this before in the past. Mike meant the world to us, and to find the car, you know, Frank Delvecchio had it for sale, and to bring it back from nothing. And we had to sacrifice another car to kind of get it done because we merged two frames into one just because both were trying to return to their earthly elements, and we had to make it work. But the car we actually sacrificed, the car that kind of gave what it was to the project, was it was a 1973 Eldon Mark 10A, which was a Falconer bodied car, which was the 1973 Canadian runoff pole sitter car that was the former Mike Adkin car. So it's interesting, every Eldon we've touched, and we currently have we have the finished car and three other frames in our shop right now. Every single one of them has just countless history. It's actually amazing what we've been able to run into with the Eldons, and it's a neat little fraternity, the Eldon bunch. So we might have short wheelbases, but we're big on character, it seems. So
that needs to be the sticker, or at least the suit patch. I heard it's hitting the track soon, so I'm expecting GoPro looking backwards on the red header.
There you go. So, and it's funny you mentioned that. So we're not going to race it this year. We just kind of ran out of time. In 2 weeks is the Elkhart Lake Vintage Festival, and we're going to run the Eagle at that. We really didn't want its first track day to be at Road America because, you know, walls. So we're probably going to bring it out before the VSCDA event at Blackhawk and run the test day with it. And you know, I got the Eagle scheme, you know, helmet, and I figured that out. I'll run the GoPro on the left-hand side where the AAR sticker is on my helmet, and then when I'm driving the Eldon, the camera will be on the right side where there's an Eldon sticker. So
nice.
But it'll be interesting for sure. So anyway, so you transition into a Zinc. Why is? Let me ask you, out of all the Club Fords, I know that the Zincs are considered a little bit heavier, but they did a lot of good things back in the day with a lot of very notable drivers. What pointed you toward the Zinc?
This is going to be really bad to say. Just kind of looks and oddity.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the paddock at an SVRA race, and Club Ford had started being more prevalent in vintage. I think it was around about 2005 or 2006 when they allowed Club Fords to run on treaded tires,
mm-hmm.
and that really opened the floodgates for just better field sizes, because before then you had to run slicks and you might be out there with a Benetton and you're putzing around in a Club Ford. So the Zinc was there, and we were kind of like, boy, this is, I just like unique concepts and ideas, and there weren't that many front rocker cars,
mm-hmm.
That were American made in that era.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right,
and it was ugly. The first time you see them, they're ugly, and then they kind of grow on you.
They're different, you know. I won't say they're ugly. They actually kind of remind me. So I was looking. In restoring the Eldon, in researching the Eldon, I've also researched the 1973 Formula Ford American Express Cup that my friend Michael ran. He raced in the series, ran in it. And while doing that, I'm also researching all the Americans that took part in the series over there. These were mainly servicemen and women who on the weekends, you know, they got the weekend pass, they go race somewhere. And one of them had, I forget which Royale model it is, but it's got the fiberglass side planks on it, and it looks similar to it. I mean, it's a little tankish, but with the right livery on it, like Denny McShane's car, which we'll get into how you got into so many at once. The livery of Denny's, the way it's masked up like his father's, that's a gorgeous car. So.
Oh, it is.
But definitely the design is very different. And so what series do you primarily run with?
Anything that's close?
Yeah.
No, but I really right now my favorite series is the Formula Ford Challenge series, which is predominantly in the Northeast. And gosh, they'll know numbers better than I will, but average field size is in the upper 20s for that group. So we have our own group running just for Fords, which makes life amazing. Typically for the Jefferson 500, which is one of the bigger races, and it's a haul for you, but I'm going to keep bugging you that you should do it. Maybe not with your Eagle, but another car. But
sure.
45 entries is kind of an average entry for that race around a 2 mile track.
Wow. And that's at, is that at Summit Point?
It is. It is, which isn't a really technical track, and it doesn't have a lot of passing areas, but it does have that really cool nostalgic feel to it.
Sure.
Which is, you know, that's cool. We're in old cars, so we might as well get the feel.
Right. Right. So you have this Zinc. You are very much considered a front runner wherever you show up. How does one make a Zinc, which was designed for slicks, a fast car on treads?
Sometimes by accident, truthfully. I've kind of learned this the hard way and had, I may have had as many as at least 7 or 8 through my 24 by 24 garage, and I have yet to find 2 Z10 frames that are the same. And they're all just close enough to sucker you into thinking you can set them up the same, and you just can't. My car was, I'll say, a bit of a historically correct car, or important car, although it wasn't runoffs type of car. A guy named Rex Gunning built this car. I believe it's called a Z10 because it was, he got it as a kit, which most Z10s were, but nobody really knows that, so everybody calls them Z10s because nobody would recognize a Z10. And so Rex built this thing and had some success with it. He ended up wrecking it at one point and decided that it could use some more Ackerman and probably a wider track in the front. So he fabricated these wider rockers and these crazy looking Ackerman arms, and it eliminated the understeer problem the cars had. And so those measurements then, I guess, word spread, and that got sold as the kit for the C. So everybody says they have a C, but rarely do they really have a C. Half the time it's an A, which is a narrower front end. And Rex was real successful with that car. He ended up building the aero nose, which was modeled after an ADF. And that's the nose that you see on a lot of Z10s now. And he had over 100 SCCA wins. But when I got it, you know, vintage was competitive at that time, and I put it on the scales, and it needed to lose 70 pounds to get down to the 950 minimum weight. So, you know, that was quite an undertaking, and that made the car really, really quick and really competitive with that. So we didn't really need to do too much to that car. We bought a sister car in 2011 and started building it for my dad. And that car was the the NARC champion. At least 1 year, maybe two, but it came with an inch and a half thick binder of just shock and spring testing that previous drivers did. So, we took advantage of that and then kind of married that setup onto my car, and it worked really well. And Dad's car and my car were equal on the racetrack, and then we tried to make Dad's car better and inadvertently made it way worse, and we didn't really know.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. The roll centers in the front move around quite a bit on these if they're not just right.
Okay. Interesting. And I asked you about, you know, especially a car that was designed for slicks going to treads. Obviously, my Eagle's the same way. And now I have this Eldon that I can't wait to get my fingers on, which, you know, Eldons in North America, that back in the day they said they were awful because they were just twitchy and heavily oversteer because of the short wheelbase. Well, it was also designed for a shredded tire, and all of a sudden everyone's throwing Goodyears on them, slicks.
Exactly.
So I can't wait. I am literally like a shark who just got my first whiff of a lovely, lovely little seal that's washed back upstream, because I don't think anyone's thorough, you know, and I shouldn't say this. I don't want to put anyone down, but I don't feel that an Eldon over here has been thoroughly tested and worked over in many, many years with treads, because there hasn't been a need because it ran on slicks forever. So
I agree with you. One of my kind of newfound passions in the last 4 years, and this was again because I kind of had to do it because I was trying to kind of reverse engineer and figure out what all of a sudden made Dad's car slower than my car. And so we would switch seats and go back and forth, and what I found was I sat there and I said, Dad, I can, and we put little aim solos on there so I could go back and forth with the data, and so we'd have the same driver in the same car, and said, Dad, I can enter the corner at the same speed, get the same apex, but I'm having to feed the throttle in your car, and in my car I just, you know, treat the throttle like a toggle switch. It's on or it's off.
Yeah.
And so then when I every time you read a Carol Smith book, you get something new out of it that you've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was probably on my 12th reading of Tune to Win, and I pick up this little line of him saying how important it was that the roll centers move in the same direction. I said, okay, I need to address this. And so I finally measured everything, and sure enough, Dad's roll center was moving like feet to the outside of the corner in the front, and mine was moving like 6 inches to the inside of the corner. And so I think a lot of that is, leads into your point on just going through the Eldon on treads. I kind of feel like this generation of cars somewhat got left behind in the development stages because, slicks over here really started getting used in 73 to 74.
Right.
And by that time, a lot of designs were already, out of the factory. The Lola 340s come to mind.
Right.
The 342s. And so I've done roll center kind of analysis on those, and they always have that bad reputation of the flexi, flyer. And I think maybe that's not untrue, but I think it is a little unfair in that you put slicks on a car, and maybe a weakness all of a sudden becomes, just an absolute crippling thing for the car setup.
Right.
And then you've got to stiffen the springs, and it just is a slippery slope from there. But I think once the DB1 came out, it was such an improvement in design that if you wanted to go fast, you had to just get a DB1, and so all these other cars kind of got forgotten as far as development goes, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned this up. So when we first bought the Eagle back in 2009, we first started running it in 2010. We ran it on R25 Hoosiers in SCCA racing, which was terrible.
Oh, nice.
But running it, it didn't matter. It stuck like shit to a blanket, and I couldn't tell if the car had any faults. I mean, it was literally like having three drinks and then going out on a date. It's probably going to be a great date. However, it tore the car apart. And really, it's so much more fun to run on the treads now. And I look at, again, with this Eldon project, it's history of what I'm dialing it into to make it back to the way it was in 73 with some enhancements to prolong its longevity. It's, you know, every photo I've seen of this car running in Europe in 73, it's either sideways or the tires are just deflecting like mad. And I think they ran on street tires that season. But it's, to your point, the unfairness that's brought upon a chassis that may have been a stinker in one realm or one area of the world because of the tire choice, it's very unfortunate. And when you look at the world beater that is a DB1, when people are forced to run on treads and all of a sudden it comes back down to earth against some of the vintage cars, it's so telling of what a tire is to a car that so many people overlook.
Exactly. And one of the things, to your point, that I love about the treads, and once people get used to them, I think they really love them too, is the trick to driving the treads quickly is to figure out how to get the treads to transition from, you know, acceleration to braking and from braking to cornering. And the slicks have so much grip that you don't have to be as precise. They cover up a lot of setup and driver error in that part of the corner. And so the treads really ask more out of the driver just to be mechanically empathetic. And so once you get that, it's just so much more fun to drive.
Right. So on that end, you've said you've had many Zincs come through your shop to different degrees, and we face the same thing with the Eldon frames in that they're all a little bit different, and who knows along the line where things got changed, whether it was a year after or it was a wreck or whatever. You've sold some off, and again, like Denny's cars, amazing. When you sell a car, how do you feel once it leaves your shop? Do you feel like, oh, there goes my youngster off into the wild? Or, I mean, what's it like for you, seeing that so many have come through your hands?
You know, a little bit, but I always kind of looked at it. I really want the car to be with the correct person, just to have the correct vintage experience and to be a good curator of the car. Denny's car kind of fell in my lap, and Denny made the mistake of seeing me at the 50th and saying how much he enjoyed seeing a Zinc running up front because his dad had did it. And so a car comes up for sale, and this thing was an absolute time capsule. It hadn't run since 78, and it basically had been garage kept. It only had 11 races on it.
Wow.
Two races on a Joe Stamola refresh of the engine.
Wow.
It was really cool to unlock and really kind of see what a top engine builder did in 78 to these engines and how different it is to today. But I kind of put a post out that, yeah, I'm headed to get this thing. And sure enough, before I get home, Denny has said, so has anybody bought that car? Okay, here we go. So, I mean, it didn't hit my driveway before, you know, he contacted me, and, you know, was new to vintage racing, but definitely seemed like the right person to have in the paddock.
Right.
And he gave me more and more pictures of his dad's car, and I said, you know, that's really a cool livery. I'd wanted to do one like the Johnny Lightning special paint scheme, just because I thought maybe that's the closest the Formula Ford has looked like that. And John Gaither ran a Z10 that had a very similar paint scheme in the runoffs. in the day. So I said, that would be really cool. And then he started sending me pictures of his dad's car. And I said, I tell you what, I'll build this car. You don't have to buy it, but if you say no, it'll hit the market. And so I built it as close to his dad's as we could get it.
Mm-hmm.
I drove it in testing. He asked that I test it for him and just kind of shake everything down. And I wasn't really leaning on the engine much, but at VIR, my home track, there were some of the more skilled sections of the track. That car was 0.4 seconds faster than my car. And I come in the pits, and Elizabeth's there, my wife Elizabeth is there helping crew for me, and I get out, and she looked at me, and she said, we are not beating it. I must have had a look on my face. And so at that point, Benny and I had already agreed to terms, and I told him, I said, I am so grateful you're taking this car, because otherwise I would have had to keep it. It just was a magical car, and
wow,
it has my favorite body on it by far.
Sure. And it's funny you mentioned the narrow nose that came to Zinc's. Lee Storr actually made a similar one for Eldon's in the early 80s, just trying to prolong their careers, which, again, that might have been a moot point on slicks. But anyways, getting ahead of myself. So you've done a lot of analysis of suspension geometry with regard to original specifications versus how cars are run these days. What have you felt, or do you have any conclusions on that? What are people doing right? What are people doing wrong?
So I went into it really hoping that I'd have this aha formula and direction of everything, and kind of the more I look at things, the more kind of confusing it all gets.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some cars are extremely ride height sensitive. You know, a 16th or an 1/8 of an inch all of a sudden changes the way the car behaves by a significant margin. And other cars, like the, you know, ubiquitous Crosley, you know, the strength of Crosley is they really don't do anything bad.
Mm-hmm.
The weakness of Crosley is they really don't do anything bad. So you can go past its sweet spot in the setup, and you don't really know it because you're just kind of out of there and taking little incremental steps in the wrong direction, and it doesn't do anything bad, so it's still kind of okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's been kind of eye opening. I've looked at some cars that were designed for slicks and, you know, are now running on treads, and all of a sudden the roll center shifts from in a corner, may go from the inside all of a sudden to the outside, and it's kind of like, well, this car's going to handle way differently. And that's kind of been my newer kind of, I guess, philosophy or mantra is, let me get the roll axis consistent, and then I'll base my springs and everything else on where that roll axis is located. Cars like Lolas that typically have higher roll axes,
mm-hmm.
Closer to the center of mass, you're going to run a softer spring than a car like a Z16 that's, you know, got a roll center below the ground.
Right.
And you know, once you negate out the motion ratio part of it, the same corrected spring, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
That stuff to me is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more I know, the less I know.
Yeah, I totally understand that. I totally understand that. You know, I've looked at notes. I've seen David Loring's original notes for the Eagle, and looked at what he ran for springs, what he was running for tow, and I don't dare put that setup on my car, because the Eagle, as it is, if I don't have a little bit of understeer in it, I will lose the car. I can't I can't keep the back end under me. And that that tail, so David got into a giant mess of a wreck at Riverside in early 78. It was midway through the season when the Eagle had a short little stubby tail, similar to, what do I want to say? Whatever. It was just a, it was a little duck tail that ended at the back of the bulkhead.
And kind of like a Merlin 11 or a Lola 342.
There you go. There you go. It didn't have a tip up on it, nothing. It just kind of augured down, and there it was.
Got it.
So in high speed turns, they had issue, or he had issues with it keeping the back in. And what got it stuck was, of course, the little gurney flap on the 36 inch long tail, because that's as long as you can go from the center line of the rear axle via SECA rulebook. And that's all that did it. Now, if I were to run, I think the original setup was 250 front springs, 130 rears.
Okay, well,
if I did that, and I like a stiff car, I came out of karting, I don't like, I don't, you know, rolling over unsettles me. I don't like it. I don't like feeling like I'm rolling over in a couch. I like to be feeling like I'm strapped into a race car. That's it's the only direction I want to go is forward. And and so we run quite a bit stiffer, and I keep looking back at the notes like, I want to try it because I want to feel that what that was like. And then I go, you can't. Again, he was on slicks. He was on Goodyear's. Firestone some weekends, even though they were sponsored by Goodyear. And so it's that weird dynamic of, you know, I always feel like I'm always trying to chase history down because I always want to make the car faster, but with respect to what it was, because the number one goal that I try to do while driving that car is to try to make people forget where they are. I want to make them feel like they're still back in 1977, 78 and seeing a brand new Eagle at speed, because it's not something you see every day.
I think that's correct, because I particularly when there's fans in the stands, I don't care if I come in first, second, or third, as long as I can put on a good show for them, and make them feel like, hey, this guy is wringing its neck just like they did in the day on a Zinc. And I guess to get back to the previous point with all that and flakes in the tread, I think a lot of the, even looking at the historical pictures of our series in the U.S. that ran flakes versus, you know, Canadian and European and everywhere else in the world that ran treads, the cars that ran treads often had a minimum ride height they had to meet, which typically had high roll centers, which then meant they needed to run bigger slip angle to generate grip. And that's just a different feel for how you drive the car. Whereas our pictures, the guys aren't hanging them out nearly as much as, you know, the same driver overseas would be.
Right.
I think that's probably most likely due to the slick. So I'm with you. I love a stiff car. I actually run 1,000-pound springs in the front of my car and 800 pounds on the outboard suspension in the back.
Wow. Holy cow.
That's 950s in the back.
I don't think we have that in our Eagle Indy cars. I mean, that's...
I know, and again, that car, initially, it was something stupid soft, like 200 or 300 pounds in the back that it initially called for, and it just makes you think, you know, well, the physics never changed. The physics is the same physics it was back in 1975. Why in the world is it faster on that much stiffer springs?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, where do you see Club Ford, Vintage Ford, where do you see all this going? Do you feel like it's trending in a positive direction? And with that, I have to say, we're close to where we were at the 50th. Obviously, a little thing came called COVID got in the way a bit. But I feel like after these 10-year reunions, I feel like the steam kind of goes for a while, and then it might drop off and then pick up again. But what are your thoughts? So where's all this headed, and why?
Well, I'm really kind of enthusiastic about it because, you know, I anticipated a huge sell-off after all the participation from the 50th. And I just didn't see it. There were cars that would pop up, but it wasn't that much more than in the normal, you know, season of racing, which tells me more people stuck with it, which is great because I really think Club Ford is the best bang for the buck, and it's also the most user friendly car because. People, they had just started figuring out how cars really worked as race cars, but they also weren't so sophisticated that you had to be an engineer and have a set of scales with you every time you came off the racetrack like they did in the following generations. So I think it's kind of that sweet spot of just it feels real visceral and it's also friendly, and I think people have just enjoyed the vintage paddock and lifestyle, or I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, once they get in a car that feels like what a car should feel like, my car, I've registered peak GPS longitudinal G-forces at 1.8 Gs. I mean, you can't pay $1 million and get a street car that does that.
Right. Well, unless you hit something really good.
You can go spend $15,000 and what's that?
I said, unless you hit something really good.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not the speed that gets you.
It's that stopping real fast. Yeah. My driving instructor in high school said that.
But you know, it's kind of like you can pick one of these cars up for, you know, between 15 and 30, all of a sudden get that experience, and it's like, man, you know, you could spend that on suspension on your Mustang and still not have a race car.
Right.
So I think it looks real good for the sport. And I was worried. In fact, my wife was really the one that said this 10 years ago, and she said, we're by far the youngest people in this paddock year in and year out. It just seems more people, you're my age, are starting to get into it and maybe be established enough in their careers to start having some fun spending money. And it seems like the car guys are getting, and girls are getting into it.
Right. So, and on that end, what do you enjoy the most out of all of this?
It's a lot of things, but it started as a family sport for me. It was a great way, as a teenager, for me and my dad to spend time together in the garage. You know, that's always awkward being a teenager, but in the garage, it was, you know, a universal language. And I'm, as a dad now, I'm really starting to experience that with my daughters. My oldest, Abby, is really taking an interest in the technical side of things, and she also likes to watch races from the strategic side. And my youngest, Claire, is just an absolute ruthless competitor. So she'll let me hear it if I do something wrong that she sees on the racetrack, and I can't get out of my car before I hear it. So I don't know of another sport that you can interact and with such a wide range of ages, and you know, male and female, and all have a say in the car that goes out on the track and actually feel a part of the results.
Yeah. So conversely, out of all of this, what don't you like about what we're all doing?
It's very clicky, and I understand why there are so many different vintage organizations. We used to have a pretty universal rule set with Ron Aposto. That got thrown by the wayside I think when the West Coast guys really started bolting aluminum rims on the classic boards, and then a lot of things kind of fell after that. So I would really like to see more universal rules. And also driver conduct be more universal as far as reporting systems go.
I'm with you 3,000% on that one.
The right now, the BMC, from what I hear, only sends out an email once quarterly to one person at each organization. It has kind of the no-fly list on it. And if I'm on that, there's theoretically nothing stopping me from late entering and showing up and putting cash. And, you know, the volunteer at the racetrack doesn't necessarily have that list in front of them. So that, to me, just doesn't make sense. You know, I want to know the people I'm racing around, and I want them to know me.
Right, right. And I'm not against tar and feathering in public either. So
sometimes that's the only way to get things done. I used to try to kind of have one-on-ones, and that worked. And somewhere about, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, people just didn't want to do that. It was almost like it swapped over to an SCCA paddock. And so thankfully videos exist, and nothing fixes somebody's driving like seeing them, you know, act like a moron on camera.
So my crew chief, Paul J., he came from midget racing. Some of the best Midwestern midget racers he was a stooge for. And he once told me a quote that was, just because you came with a set of teeth doesn't mean you're going to leave with them. So I thoroughly enjoy many of his isms, and especially that one. So
that's great.
So you wake up tomorrow, your Zinks are missing, and there's no Zinks to be found anywhere. What car would you put your insurance money towards?
Oh, that's a very good question. I wasn't ready for that. I really like the 81 Van Diemen's, not just because I stared at the back of Jeremy's for the entire 50th, but they're just well-built, pretty cars. I think if parts were more readily available, there's something about an 84 Renard that just looks right. I've done the classic Ford thing. It's awesome, but you feel like you just went 10 rounds with Mike Tyson when you get out of those things. And a club Ford, you feel like you went for a Sunday drive. They're both the exact same speed, but the experience is totally different.
And I'm looking forward to that very much. So
buckle up, buttercup.
Yeah, well, it's funny. So I sit in the Alden, and I feel like Magilla Gorilla, where I actually look like a Rat Fink type character, where I'm sitting on the car, and it's gonna be interesting. I'll say that.
I think it'll be great. I think they should film drivers getting in the cars.
You don't want to see that. Literally, I have to. When I get in the Eldon, I actually have to hold on to the rear trailing arms because I can't put my hands down in the cockpit because it's so tight up against me. And for those of you who are listening who've never seen my gorgeous physique, I'm 6'2", 240. So think of all that spilling into the car. But it's definitely, strapped in, it feels just like the Eagle, except the steering wheel's a little smaller and the cockpit's a little bit more all up and close to you. But anyways, another question.
It'll be a sight to see, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So in your years of racing, who is the best driver that no one's heard of that you've raced against?
I really think without question, I would put Doug Meese in that category. Doug and Doug didn't have his typical weekend at the 50th, and given he was at a large disadvantage at Road America because he was driving a Lola, which is an absolute brick. But, you know, he's a guy, he's raced for years, he's raced all different sorts of cars and vintage. But, you know, we do point buys, and we've gotten a lot of grief for that. But we do it so we can break the draft and so we don't slow both cars down.
Right.
But both of us, we haven't tangled yet. I'm surprised we haven't, because we've been racing wheel to wheel for 10 years, but there's just a point where it's almost like motorcycles, and we have mirrors, but we just kind of know where the other guy is and don't need to use them.
Right, right. And I, so Doug finished right behind me at the 50th, and then sent me a message afterwards. It was like, yeah, you knew I was there, and I knew you were there, and I won't say who you're stuck behind, but none of us were going to do anything stupid to go home or to not be able to roll our car into the trailer, which is the most important part of all of this, which again, some fail to realize. And obviously,
Doug has the best rule, I think, that of any racer I've ever heard, and I'll probably botch it, but it goes a little something like this, of... don't do anything this session that will prevent you from going out next session.
Right. Right. That's huge.
And he abides by that.
That's so big. And it's seen all too often where that people fail to realize that.
And I had to get away from you at the 50th, because when we were running, I guess it was Friday or Saturday together, I hadn't been on track with any. I've seen Eagles a bunch, but I had never been on track wheel to wheel with one. Mm-hmm. And I kept staring at your car, which at a new track wasn't going to end well for either one of us.
Right. Yeah, it's got a hypnotic appeal to it, I will say. So, and that was so weird, because that qualifying session, and of course we're talking about something that happened 2 years ago. We had 73 cars on track, and I did not have a clean lap. If you take my qualifying lap and my fastest lap in the race, I went four and a half seconds quicker in the race per lap than I did in qualifying. I mean, I was dive bombing people trying to get a quick lap. And when I got in from qualifying, I think I threw my steering wheel. I was like, God damn it. I was like 238 at Road America. I'm going to be like 30th. And Paul brings his phone, drops it in the cockpit, and P8. What?
Yeah.
What? Was this the first lap? Are you sure? So it was just so bizarre. But that was a case of, that, you know, I had never been on a track, you know, except in spec Miata racing. I had never been on track with so many cars at once. And when you do the math, I mean, 73 cars over 4 miles, it's doable. It shouldn't be bad. But yeah, that was an interesting weekend for sure. And
you definitely have to have a partner to work together in that scenario, because these cars are so draft sensitive that you really do. And if you enter any corner too wide, you know that, hey, that's great, it's racing, but just realize you're no longer going for the win. You know, you're now going just for that one position.
Yeah.
When that happens, and I think a lot of guys forget that and expect the next corner worker station to display a checkered.
Right. Yeah. That's so on point, because especially at a place like RA. Congratulations, you just won that corner. That driver you just passed is going to pass you into the next corner, because that straightaway is 3/5 of a mile long. Congratulations.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to tact and rolling into the trailer. So. Well, sir, that was all the questions I had lined up. Is there anything else you want the people... And I will say this. So, again, it's been 54 weeks since I did an interview. The last interview was Doug Smith, and I think Doug felt bad, because I think he felt like he ruined it for everyone, because I hadn't done one for so long. But we have had hits from all over the world. Brazil was big. Germany, the Netherlands, England, Ireland. Gotta talk for my Irish brethren in my blood. We're big in Canada. We're big in Mexico, and of course here in the States, with California being our biggest listenership. But is there anything else you'd like to pass along to anybody about your time in the sport, your car, your personal life? The floor is yours.
I'm a guy that likes to talk, but you've left me speechless. I just love the sport. I think it's great. I think it's the right balance, and the people are awesome. Come out and see what you can do. People are friendly, and you never know. People are more likely to lend you cars than you think they are.
I guess I'll try to remember that last point, especially if you want me to come to the Jefferson 500. I mean, I'm all ears. I'll say that much. So
yeah, I mean, we should make that happen. I really think we could do something where we just kind of get not a full beater, but kind of a school and regional car, where if we get some of these select drivers come by and every series has just kind of this loner car, it'd be great to just get a good California driver to not have to haul their car the whole way and say, hey, come drive this and have a good time.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on there. So
stop restoring them so nicely and just put one out.
But Scott, I like things pretty.
COVID made things way too shiny. You need to get some dirt on them and
that's,
some rubber
that's
and oil.
All that we'll talk about with COVID, it made things shinier. And my facial hair had more than 5 arrangements. So,
yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Fairchild, I appreciate you coming on to Kentish. And we look forward to seeing you in the tracks coming soon. Where's your next outing?
I'm going to be doing the Gold Cup with SVRA at VIR at the end of September. I hope we can get some more Fords coming out. I'm looking forward to running Tim Madrid, supposed to be coming out for that. So I'm really looking forward to that. And my girls will want a autograph from the hot pink lady.
With the greatest mohawk in all of Club Ford.
Always. The only one that can pull it off in the paddock.
All right, Scott. Well, thank you for your time, and we look forward to seeing you on track soon with your Zinc.
Thank you. I'll be well.
All right. Thank you.